Live from a bunker in the heart of the Ozarks, a podcast that thinks we should let the internet name the Pope, Popey McPoperson, of course, it's SIFPO. Welcome to SIFPOP, available in your podcast feed every Monday, unless, of course, you get it early as a patron.
Patrons get perks.
Patrons get those perks. I'm your host, Aaron Dicer. Each week, we'll chat about movies, TV, and whatever else from the pop culture universe is on our minds. Long time no see, Mr. Ormsby.
I know. Been over a month now since we've done the show. Yeah. A lot has happened in the weeks that have, you know, transpired since we last did the show.
Yeah, since we don't usually go this long, or we haven't before, should we take extra time to talk about, like, stuff we've seen in that time? Like, is there stuff you want to talk about from your life, you know, from the last month? Like, it's been a hot minute.
I hit 2 deer in 1 day.
Oh, okay. Well, the important stuff, then.
Yeah.
We'll start with...
That's the craziest thing.
Doicide.
Yeah. I actually took a sabbatical from watching movies over our little vacay here, just to, you know, a little bit of a palate cleanser, you know.
Sure.
And I thought I'd travel, not as much as you. So, you know, I took some day trips to Kansas City and stuff like that. And one day at 4 in the morning, my friends and I hit a deer and didn't total my friend's car, thank goodness, just some fender bender stuff. But then 8 o'clock that night, we had to switch to my car because of what happened to his. 8 o'clock of that night, I hit a deer in my car and totaled my car. Like, it obliterated my car.
Wow. That's that's probably unfortunate for the deer as well.
The deer's not having a good day for sure.
No. No. Did it actually manage to scamper off, or was it time to call in animal control?
I couldn't find the deer.
Okay.
Besides the parts that were still in my car. I'll just say that.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I thought we were through gory season.
No.
It's November now.
Gory season has just begun.
No. It's November now.
Thanksgiving.
Unbelievable. I don't think we hit any wildlife during our time in
the UK.
But we did have a great time. I continue to be amazed by natural beauty and how it changes throughout the world. You know, like, we live in a country, we're privileged enough to live in a country that has a lot of different natural beauty within our country.
Like, very diverse.
You know, yeah, there's a lot of different, you know, types of geological exploration you can do in this giant country we live in. But even so, aside from a few bits of coastline in the Northwest and maybe a tad bit in the Maine, you know, kind of area, most of our coastline is sandy beaches, you know, those kind of things. You go to Ireland and the coast is just cliffs. And the biggest, most impressive, most dynamic cliffs you've ever seen. And it's not just like, oh, hey, let's go to that one section where there's cliffs on, you know, the west of Ireland. It's the whole thing. The whole thing. It was a real privilege to get to see that and be in that place. Ireland was amazing. The UK was amazing. London was amazing. Got to see, I guess I can mention this, this fits into pop culture even, saw 3 shows in London, saw the opening night of Doctor Strangelove, the new Doctor Strangelove adaptation, his name just slipped my brain.
Not Kubrick.
No, the adaptation was not by Kubrick. He is no longer with us. I'll look it up here short. I always want to say Iñárritu, which is wrong.
Cuarón?
No, it's not even one of them. It's not even one of that crew. But anyways, it was Coogan starred in it, and he played four different roles and was in the entire thing. and just absolutely Iannucci. Just remembered it. Iannucci.
Oh, Armando.
Armando Iannucci adapted it, which is perfect. The perfect person to adapt Strangelove with all the stuff he's done with political satire and those kind of things. And anyway, so we saw opening night, and it was kind of amazing. Not just because the play was really well adapted and really well done, which I think it was, and it was a lot of fun. Not only because Coogan was absolutely a powerhouse, which he was, but because it was opening night, they were still kind of sanding the edges off, which is always, you know, interesting to watch. There were three line calls during the night. Like, and I've never seen that on like the biggest stage, somebody call for line, you know. There were three moments where somebody had to do a line call. Mm. So that was, which I find really fascinating and fun, and, you know, breaks the immersion a little bit, but honestly at a stage show, the immersion is kind of already broken because it's right there in the building with you. And often stage shows are a little more, fourth wall ambivalent, fourth wall agnostic, just because the fourth wall is such a important part of the stage performance. So anyways, that was really good. Then we saw, we went from the newest show, running show, being opening night, to the longest running show in the history of plays. We went and saw Mousetrap, Agatha Christie's Mousetrap. And that was so much fun. And I think our show was in the 29,700 range performances. So the Mousetrap coming up on its 30,000th performance here in the next year or so. Just astonishing that show has been doing that for so long.
It must be good.
Had a lot of fun with it. It is good. It's really good. It was a lot of fun. And then at the last second decided to go see the Stranger Things show in London, the Stranger Things prequel show, which is really, really, I mean, interesting in that it ties into the show so well. It's basically Vecna's backstory, if that makes sense. Or not Vecna, but Patient Zero, you know, who
I think
becomes
it's Vecna.
Yeah. Anyways, Vecna was not his given name. Let's just say that.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. But yeah, so to see that was really cool. To see these Brits trying to do American accents was really fun. some more successful than others. But Hopper and Joyce were perfect. Just perfect high school examples of Hopper and Joyce, which was a lot of fun. So yeah, had a great time. Did a lot of fun, cool stuff, and glad to kind of be back and back and relaxing on my own couch a little bit. Just in time to watch 100 movies in 2 weeks.
Yep. It's the fun time of year for Aaron Dicer, ladies and gentlemen.
It's all movies all the time. Oh, poor me having to watch so many movies.
We joke about, you know, like how hard life must be that our job is to watch movies. But we also have to consider the fact that there are only so many hours within a day. So
it's true.
That having to watch a lot of movies can be overwhelming.
It can be. It can be. But I will never take for granted how fun it is that is the pain. You know what I mean? Like, of all the pains you could experience in your life, of all the trauma you could go through, the trauma of having to watch a bunch of movies will always be a privilege. So yeah, that's the season I'm in right now. But the very moment I'm in right now, Mr. Ormsby, is an episode of Sif Pop where we've got a couple movies to discuss. We're going to talk about Venom the Last Dance, which just came out, and Conclave, which I think just went wide as well. Both of these, of course, going for Oscars. Just kidding. But one of them is. I'll let you decide which one. We'll also do some buried treasure and do a best ever challenge too. In fact, we'll kick it off with some buried treasure. What do you want to talk about, Andrew? What's that one thing in any area of pop culture that you want to let people know about?
Well, I said last time we were doing the show that I was going to hold off on my review for The Penguin until later. Well, later is now.
Later has arrived.
Yes. There are only two episodes left. But right now, I think I can confidently say this is my favorite show on TV right now.
Oh, nice. I really, it's on my list. Again, anything on my list right now probably won't get touched till January, but it's definitely on my TV list.
I don't know, just from what I know of you, Aaron, I don't know if this is a show for you, because this feels so much like Goodfellas or The Godfather. It is so much about the criminal underbelly of Gotham and how people find themselves in the criminal underworld, not by choice sometimes. Some people just, it's bad luck and they find themselves in this world. But then you have people like Oswald Cobb who want to be remembered as the great gangster of Gotham, you know? Mm-hmm. And they... It's interesting because I'll be watching the show and I will totally forget it's a Batman show. Pattinson's not in it. For those of you who are wanting to see, you know, Batman, this is not a Batman show. This is a Penguin show. This is all about the seedy underbelly of Gotham. And if you are not ready to handle HBO's version of the seedy underbelly of Gotham, then this is your warning right here. The show does not hold back. Compared to the movie, which was PG-13, this is a hard R TV show. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of language. But it's good. I think that there are so many Emmys that I can give out for this show, you know. I'm going to look up her name because I have to give her the credit she deserves, because I think that she is stealing this show. That would be Deirdre O'Connell, who plays Frances Cobb, who is Oswald's mom. Just give her Emmy right now, because this is some of the best acting I've seen in a very long time. Also, just from you saw the Batman and you saw how good the prosthetics were for Colin Farrell. Aces all around here for the prosthetics for him and for everybody else who needs it in this show. He just immerses himself in this role. It's great. But he doesn't carry the weight of the show on his shoulders, which is the big thing, because I was afraid going into the show, which I was very excited for, that it was just going to be the Colin Farrell train and that it was just going to be him in the train just hauling everybody else behind him. But it's not.
He's not even in the show. So, you know, that's
it's true.
Weird.
It's true. It's crazy how much he just falls into that role and you forget that it's actually him. But Kristen Milioti, she might be up for an Emmy as well. Renzi, Felice, there's just so many great performances in this show. I can't recommend it enough that it might be the best show of the year.
Nice. I will watch this. And I've had enough good buzz from enough people to go, okay, I'll give it a try. And just because it's about, you know, gangsters or whatever, doesn't mean I'll hate it. You know, it depends on where it falls on the shiny versus grimy spectrum. You know, is it shiny gangsters or is it grimy gangsters? Because I don't mind if it's a little bit grimy, where it's clear that this life is taking a toll and it's darker, and it's just when it gets like exciting and fun and then adrenaline and amazing that it gets a little annoying to me. So
I'll say this then real quick. There are shows like The Goodfellas which do glorify the life of gangsters and stuff.
I don't think that's, by the way, I don't think that's the intent. I think it's a possible consequence of that narrative. So anyways,
continue. But this is a show, like a lot of gangster films, that a lot of people could argue doesn't have a good guy.
Yeah.
Because everybody in this show is awful. It's just kind of like the good, the bad, and the ugly. Clint Eastwood isn't the good. He's still a bad guy, you know? It's just he's the least of three evils. So that's kind of how you can look at the show. Oswald Cobb isn't the bad guy. He's just the least of all the evils in this show.
And that is on Max, if you want to check that out. Or HBO. And that is The Penguin. You mentioning The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly reminded me of something that I'm just going to tell this story as an aside before I get into my buried treasure. But I was talking with my son. We, for whatever reason, were on the conversation of The Lion King 1.5. And this is something they used to watch when they were kids all the time. Came out in 2004, right in that area when they all were little kids. And we used to watch this together all the time. It's actually a really fun retelling of The Lion King from Timon and Pumbaa's point of view. It's very much Rosemere Katz and Gildenhog. If the Lion King is Hamlet. thank you. If Lion King is Hamlet. And so it's a lot of fun, but there's this bug eating contest in it that Simba has with Timon, and the score is Enrico's, you know.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And my son said he felt foolish one time because there was a question on, like, they were playing trivia or something and or watching something, and it was like, you know, where, what is this song from? And it was, Lion King 1.5.
No. He's not wrong.
You don't know what you don't know. Like, and there's so many things, even... Like for instance, even in the original Lion King, when Pumbaa goes, "They call me Mr. Pig" or whatever, I didn't get that the first time I watched that. I hadn't seen whatever that movie is. They call me
Mr. Tibbs.
Tibbs.
Now I'm blanking on it. Midnight.
The Sidney Poitier film.
Yeah.
It is. One of those things where you just don't, if you see something that's referenced, but you don't know the original reference, it flies by you. It's like when my kids were like, saw Star Wars for the first time and they're like, "Hey, they stole that from Toy Story," you know, or, those kind of things. It's just weird how that happens sometimes. Anyways,
In the Heat of the Night, by the way, it was going to drive me crazy if I didn't say it out loud. In the Heat of the Night.
Such a good movie. It's really, really good. I just hadn't seen it the first time I had seen Lion King. I'm going to go with a movie that so far in 2024 is the movie most people were like, "Dicer, you have to see this movie. This movie is such a movie for you. See this movie." And the movie is called The Wild Robot. And I did get around to seeing. Have you seen it?
I have not. I actually have tickets to see it tonight.
Oh, well, enjoy. This is one of those weird examples where it's going to sound like I don't like the movie just because I don't like it as much as everybody thought I was going to like it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I like this movie, really like this movie. I think it's really, really good, and we need more movies like this. You know, I hesitate to gender the idea of care, but that is, you know, something culturally that we've seen as far as motherhood, and, you know, the idea that this robot becomes a mom is not specifically tied to gender, other than the voice is voiced by a woman, Lupita Nyong'o. So it's good. It's really on the surface, though. This is one of those things where I watch this movie, and to me, I think this is the kind of movie people think Pixar movies are when they don't really see the depth of them.
This is DreamWorks, right?
Yeah, this is DreamWorks. And when I say Pixar, I also mean Dream. Like, How to Train Your Dragon is also a great, deep, powerful movie that The Wild Robot just never gets there. I don't feel like it ever finds its real depth to talk about what it wants to talk about, which doesn't make it a bad movie. It just makes it a very simple movie that didn't give me a lot to chew on, if that makes sense. And it didn't really have that extra level of oomph that also buries itself in your soul as opposed to just warming your heart. So this is a very heartwarming movie, but there's nothing about it, at least for me. There are no moments, there are no things for me where it was like, "Oh, I feel that in my core," you know, kind of thing. And I know that's a really weird distinction to make, but it is kind of what separates like a transcendent movie for me, from just a really good movie. And I just think this is a really good movie. And, that doesn't mean people were wrong when they said, I would love it. It just means it maybe wasn't, the movie that I thought it was going to be based on what people, were saying. So definitely worth a watch. Definitely beautiful. One of the most gorgeous animated movies of the year. But Inside Out 2 is 10 times the movie this is, in my opinion, like because of the depth and the soul stuff in Inside Out 2 and how it's willing to really have some things for you to chew on where this just didn't for me. So, I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it sounds like it's not a case of wrong expectations. It seems like it's a case of the movie not being as subtle as it thinks it's supposed to be with some of its messaging.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I don't think there's much subtle about this. And that can be part of the impact of why it all feels very much on the surface. So anyways, that's The Wild Robot. Still a buried treasure. Still something I would recommend you check out. It's still in theaters. I'm sure it'll be on VOD pretty soon. And you can check that out. And also check out The Penguin on Max. All right, let's get into some reviews. Andrew, let's start with The Big Dig. Let's talk about Venom, The Last Dance.
You're not going to like this.
No, I can absolutely guarantee you I'm not going to.
My home has found us.
Who sent that thing?
My creator.
Of course.
Now that I've not said the thing to you.
The symbiotes didn't come here by accident. They were running.
From what?
But then a lot of nice things turned back out there.
What's his name then?
No.
No!
Eddie and Venom are on the run, hunted by both of their worlds, and with the net closing in, the duo are forced into a devastating decision that will bring the curtains down on Venom and Eddie's last dance. The advertising for this movie has indicated this is the final Venom movie of the trilogy, and I imagine it will be, unless this movie somehow makes billions of dollars, in which case they'll make another one. Can almost guarantee it. That's how it works.
Yep.
But what did you think? Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay?
I did not like it.
Didn't like it. I'm right there with you. Pretty strong didn't like it for me as well. I think it's a bad movie, Andrew.
Yeah.
I think this is a bad movie. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very forgettable movie.
And which is possibly the worst thing you could say about a movie like this. Even if you thought the second one was silly and meaningless, you didn't forget about it. Like, it was, you know, it had an impact. It was fun. It was, you know, there were, but yeah, forgettable is unfortunately, I think, something you can say about this. But expand on your thoughts a little bit about Venom the Last Dance.
For me, I think that this plot is nonsensical. The characters were bland and not well thought out. The individual stories from the characters lead nowhere. For example, you got Juno Temple's character, who is completely forgettable in this film, and her backstory with her brother leads nowhere. It's confusing because that's just one example of where this movie thinks it's adding layers to its message, but in reality, it's just piling it onto an already messy film.
Yeah.
Now, I do think that there are several moments, not many, in this film where Eddie and Venom had semi-emotional moments together. The story of Eddie and Venom has always been one about a dysfunctional relationship, but just because something's dysfunctional doesn't mean that it's not worth fighting for. And if there is a message in this film, I think that that's the attempted message. I think it's more obvious in this film than any other film that Eddie and Venom really do care for one another. If I do have one pro for this movie, it's that I think that this relationship between these two comes to fruition finally in this one. In the first one, you had this, what's it going to be like with the two of us together? The second movie is, what's it mean when we're apart? The third movie here is, what is worth fighting for in this relationship? But it's such an not to use the same messaging again over two films in a row, but a lot of this is on the surface, you know, a lot of it, there's not a lot of subtlety in this. And I find that I am going to forget about this movie by the time we're done talking about it.
Yeah. You touch on my favorite part of the first two movies, and specifically the first one. I don't remember specifically my review of the second one. I'd have to go back and look maybe on Letterboxd or somewhere, kind of refresh my memory, but in my current spirit, I have the movies descending in quality. I think the first one is the best. I think the second one is fine, but you know, not as good, not as meaningful as the first one was to me. And I think the third one is nothing. I think it's air. I think it's just, you know, there's not a lot to it. And I think the reason is that the only thing the movie seems to have left is the banter between the two of them. Like that's all that this movie seems to think it has to do, is to have them banter at each other. And we've been there in the first two movies, and if it's not leading somewhere new or interesting, it just gets boring. You know, that's exactly when it starts to get old. In addition, with the same kind of thing, the metaphorical marriage stuff, which I loved in the first one, the arranged marriage, kind of how do you exist with someone, how do you cohabitate with someone, that kind of stuff was so beautiful and powerful in the first movie. And then it's just kind of been there. And like each of these movies, I think, had a chance to talk about different ways that you know, cohabitating, having a long-term relationship with someone, a committed relationship, someone, different difficulties or obstacles that you might face, and maybe single one of those out and make that kind of the theme of the new Venom movie or whatever. And I don't think the movies really did that in any meaningful way. And so it's just, again, like you said, more of, you know, hey, look at these guys making it work. And now they've made it work. And okay, but what does that mean? Why is that so important to me? And how do I see, you know, myself? What can I take on an empathy level from that and apply to the world around me? And there's just not a lot of it here. It's just, and so it becomes very disappointing very fast, because then all you've got left is this mind-numbing action, which...
just nonsensical action.
Just doesn't make any sense, and is just the, you know, the whole thing. I think we've made this comparison before of Venom to the Transformers, the idea that it just, you know, the actual transforming motion or the actual thing that Venom is doing is so pointless because it could be anything. You know what I mean? It's just, it's nanobots. You know, it's just like...
yeah.
Whatever you want to do. In this case, it's I'm going to be a sticky pile of goo. In this case, I'm going, you know, to be a frog or whatever the, you know, the animal that it wants to be. So, or takes over. You know, I know in that case, there's a host that it is taking over. But it just becomes mind-numbing. And so, if that's all you've got, and you don't have a story that's interesting, there's nothing about this story that's compelling to me. I mean, where am I supposed to hang my hat? You know, like that is my question, genuine question. And Andrew, maybe you have an answer. Where does this movie want me to hang my hat? You know, like,
I think it wants you to hang your hat on the relationship between Eddie and Venom.
Okay, but you nailed that in the first movie. Like,
exactly.
Yeah,
I'm not disagreeing with you.
Andrew, I 100% agree with you. Why do you love this movie so much? No, I'm just kidding.
No. Yeah, it's one of those things, and you brought this up earlier whenever you said this codependent relationship, and it's like, yeah, that was the message of the first film. Mm-hmm. Give me something new for this one. And I think that they're thinking that if they change the relationship a little bit, then all of a sudden that makes this a new story, but it doesn't, because all relationships are changing. Mm-hmm. And just because you're adding a new thing to it doesn't mean that it's worthy for a new movie.
Right.
My biggest con for this movie, though, comes from Null. And this is just going to be me being an angry comic book guy
for
2 minutes here.
I like it.
I never felt like Null was particularly a big threat.
Okay.
Those who have read the comics, we understand how big of a threat Null represents. A villain that could potentially put Thanos to shame, power-wise and story-wise. One of the things that I loved about Thanos in the MCU is because he was so integrated into the story leading up to his arrival that we kind of understood his motivations. He wanted to get the stones. He wanted to eliminate half of the universe. So whenever it came for him to being on the screen in Infinity War, we understood his motivations and we understood what the stakes were for the story as a whole. Here, we get a 2-minute exposition on this character.
Mm-hmm.
Don't really understand how big of a threat he is. And just because you have Andy Serkis voicing him doesn't mean that that automatically gets me excited to, you know, care about this character. No,
right.
This is just the most worthless and pointless villain I've ever seen in a comic book movie.
Mm.
And it's a shame because in the comic books, he is a universal threat, even more powerful and terrifying than Thanos, Galactus. It took the Avengers, the X-Men, and Venom to defeat him in the comic books. So I can understand how maybe the studio was a little timid to use a character like this to his full potential. But at the same time, I'm like, if you're going to use a character like this, use him to his full potential.
It's wild how just completely pointless this villain is. Just pointless.
Yeah.
I honestly think the movie would have been better if we never knew who the villain was or saw the villain. If this is how you're going to handle it, just make it some malevolent unknown behind a door, and the goal of the movie is to keep the door closed. Because that's basically what this movie is.
Yeah.
And it
don't open that door.
Yeah, it did not matter at all who was behind the door, because we are not shown or even told barely in any kind of real specific way why it matters and why this villain is, you know. It was all just a lot of, oh, you don't want to deal with this guy. You know,
it's that old Stephen King homage of, you don't want to go down that road.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
That's all it is. You better not do that. Yeah, very disappointing on that front.
So even as a non-comic person, you mentioned, you know, I'm going to be a comic guy for a second here. Even as a non-comic person, the villain is annoying in that way. Mm-hmm. If you know the comics, apparently, it is even more annoying that that's who it is, but it's annoying on its own.
Yeah. To take a character who is literally the darkness of the universe. He is the darkness. Like when you look up at the night sky and all you see is black. That's mm-hmm. him. That's so cool that you could build off of that. That you could introduce this lore. And I know you're thinking this is the last movie in this franchise. And you don't really want to, you know, spend a lot of time building up. Then don't use the character. You know, have it be and this is me pitching a movie that is never going to exist.
Yeah.
Have the final movie be a dysfunction between Eddie and Venom. And then at the last minute you realize, oh, they need each other. You know, don't introduce a new villain that's not going to add anything extra to the story. Have everything that you've built up in the previous movies, like mm-hmm. this relationship between Eddie and Venom, have that be the final conflict of this film. Have that be what drives them in different directions. You introduced it a little bit in Let There Be Carnage, that there is something, there's a friction between Eddie and Venom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, they call it a perfect symbiotic relationship in the movies, but that's only on a chemistry level. On the surface, on an emotional level, these two do not get along. And there was such an opportunity in this movie for them to make this movie about that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. They just made another pointless, quote-unquote, action movie.
Yep.
Because I say quote-unquote because you can't tell what's going on.
Correct. So neither of us liked it. Let's get to our one last thing. You got anything else you want to talk about with this? Any one final thought?
Mid-credit scene and a post-credit scene. You're not getting away from this movie. They say it's the last dance, yet they're still going to add more stuff to it.
I may have missed the post-credit scene. I think I was in the theater for the mid-credit scene.
Do you want me to ruin it for you?
Sure, please. Yeah.
There's a cockroach.
Oh, okay.
That was it.
Got it. Good to know.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah.
My one last thing is, what in the world was supposed to be going on with the Reese Ifans family thing that was part of this movie? I think it was supposed to be comic relief in some ways, but it's completely unearned. It makes no sense the way they integrate it, especially towards the end. It's very discount Randy Quaid and Independence Day. Without any of the emotionality that that character had. So I was so disappointed in everything in this movie, but that family thing, I did not get it all.
It adds to the confusion because you're casting people in this movie who are already established in either the MCU or the Sonyverse. Like, you're casting Chiwetel Ejiofor in this movie when he's already Baron Mordo. Mm-hmm. You're casting Ree Sifans in this movie when he's already the Lizard in the Sonyverse.
Maybe this was how that started. I don't know. I guess it's a different universe, technically. Which, that's another thing we didn't even talk about, is how just completely hand-wavy this treats the entire multiverse thing.
At the very beginning, they're like,
it's really sad.
Such a lazy movie.
It really is, all around. Well, that's enough. That's Venom: The Last Dance. You can check it out in theaters if you are looking for some pain.
You earned a degree in the behavioral health field because you wanted to make a difference. And you're needed now more than ever. Through the new Great Minds Fellowship Program, recent Ohio graduates may be able to receive as much as $20,000 in student loan support when working full-time at a community behavioral health center. Apply before November 15th. To learn more about program eligibility, visit highered.ohio.gov. That's highered.ohio.gov.
All right, before we continue on, let's do some best ever challenge. Since it's just the two of us, let's nominate four each, shall we?
Okay.
And we will nominate Tom Hardy movies. So why don't you kick us off? What's your first nominee?
I'm going to go with Inception.
All right.
Just a brilliant movie. I love the way Christopher Nolan's mind works, and this is like at the upper echelon of what I think his prowess can do.
I'm going to nominate Warrior.
Oh, that was my next one. Not that it matters. I mean, we're just
stole
nominating
it from you. Listen, Warrior is a nice one because a lot of people I don't think have seen it. Like, it's kind of one of those that feels a little more behind the curtain than a lot of his other movies. So I highly recommend, as someone who personally not a fan of MMA, in fact, quite the opposite generally, this is an incredible movie about two brothers who are MMA fighters, and just incredible performances all around. I rewatched this recently and just it's so good. So good.
Well, because the fighting's not the point in this movie.
Right.
The fighting isn't the point. The point is about childhood trauma. It's about family dynamics. It's about so many different things that the fighting is tertiary to so many things in this movie.
Well, the fighting becomes metaphorical in many ways because the movie is, look, you're just going to get a mini Warrior review. I apologize. I don't apologize. I apologize for
Do it.
The movie is about the brother's response to family trauma and how that response differed, and how you can see in their different fighting styles how they responded to that trauma echoed. And it's really, really smart. And there's something that happens towards the end where they basically swap fighting styles and realize that there's some health to be gained, some mental health to be gained from understanding the other person. That I just think this movie's brilliant. So yeah, the fighting is as metaphorical as it is story.
Warrior. And Nick Nolte's astounding in this movie.
Very, very good. What's your second nom?
Let's go with, between two of them, I'm going to pick Black Hawk Down.
Good choice.
Because everybody in Hollywood is in this movie. Ridley Scott, he makes good movies, and this is one of them.
I agree. This was 2001.
I think it's his fourth movie
ever. I was going to say, this is really, really early on in Hardy's career. I'm trying to think, like, he really didn't break out for another 9 years, maybe. I mean, Warrior was 2011.
I think Bronson, for as little as that movie is seen, I think that's the movie that put Tom Hardy on the map.
Okay.
And then,
yeah,
and then Inception came out.
Yeah.
And that's when everybody picked up on who he was.
Yeah. So this was, again, almost a decade before that. So, it's a good chance to see early Tom Hardy for sure. So Black Hawk Down is next nomination. I'm going to throw The Revenant in there. That's not a surprise. One of my favorite movies of all time. I love this movie for many, many reasons. The performance of Leo, the audacious way it was shot, and the results of that. By the way,
who shoots in natural lighting?
It blows my mind. But here's the thing. It's not just that he shot in natural lighting. It's that that serves a purpose within the movie. Like, he uses the natural lighting to have us better understand the environment and the character in the story. And I just... He's so smart. Revenant is so good. It's so much more than just a bear attack scene.
Yeah.
What is your third nominee?
I am going to go with the 2013 movie that definitely stars Tom Hardy, directed and written by Steve Knight. I'm going to go with Locke.
Yes.
I say definitely stars Tom Hardy because he's the only person you see in this movie. There may be other people in it, but they're on a phone. And that's just people he's talking to in a car. This, for a movie that is all about a man talking about concrete and, spousal, family relationships and stuff like that. It's one of the most captivating movies I've ever seen. And so it's just good. Him in a car talking over the, the voice thing in your car, the transcript thing in your car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's wild. And for those of you who don't know, that's Tom Holland, who plays his son in this movie.
Yeah, yeah, on the phone.
Yeah.
I recently rode on this road where this was shot.
No way. So, did you talk about concrete?
We talked about concrete the entire time. That was the rule.
Nice.
For that stretch of road, we had to talk about concrete. I second this amazing movie. I love it when a movie can just be talking and you're just like zoned in because it's just so good. And I think a lot of that has to do with his ability to use the way he speaks to just captivate. I think Tom Hardy's really good. All right, so I guess it's my turn to nominate another one. I'm going to nominate Dunkirk for my next one. Would you consider this lesser Nolan? Do you think people kind of put this in the bottom of their Nolan lists usually?
I would put it in my lesser Nolans.
Mm-hmm. I don't think you're alone.
Then again, I don't think a lesser Nolan is as bad as we make it sound. Lesser Nolan is still a darn good movie.
I think this movie is great. I almost think that there is an ability to be distracted by the time thing that he's doing with the three different time sections that hinders.
It confused me the first time I saw it.
That hinders it a little bit. The way the intersections happen are really interesting, and this is a repeat viewing movie because of that. I think it's a really interesting movie to watch more than once, and it's really good. So I'm going to nominate it. There you go. That's my third. What is your fourth? What is your final nomination?
I am going to go with Mad Max Fury Road. I think that the effects in this are, bar none, some of the best. I think that this world that George Miller created is wild and fantastic. I know there are some people,
Aaron Dicer,
who think that the Furiosa movie is better than Fury Road.
I do.
I disagree, but I don't think that it's that far off. I think that both movies are phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just wildness incarnate, and I absolutely love it.
Well, you have done it, good sir. You have put me in an awkward position because I get to be the one to say that The Dark Knight Rises will not be nominated in the best ever Tom Hardy movies because I liked
the fire rises.
I liked The Bike Riders better. I know that's a fairly recent movie. I think that's this year, isn't it? No, maybe it was last year. It's this year. I think it was supposed to be last year.
It was supposed to be last year.
Held over a bunch. Man, I really liked The Bike Riders. I think this will be coming up in end of year for me as one of my favorites this year. So I had to put this that on the nomination list. In fact, that's an easier choice for me than if you had left me Mad Max Fury Road. That choice would have been a lot tougher for me, because as much as I think Furiosa is better, Mad Max Fury Road is a really good movie. So is The Bike Riders. So there you go. Those are the eight nominees. I will read them again. Inception, Warrior, Black Hawk Down, The Revenant, Locke, Dunkirk, Mad Max Fury Road, and The Bike Riders. That's quite an impressive eight movies.
Good for you, Tom Hardy.
Yeah. Nice choosing.
Yeah.
Buddy. I mean, do we really need to dance around this? I mean, it's Inception, right?
Like, okay.
That's the answer.
I had it down to three, and Inception was one of them.
What were your other two?
Warrior and The Revenant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, those would be my top three as well, but I think Inception is the right call here.
Yeah.
That movie, man. It's so good. I love it so much.
I haven't seen it in about a year. It probably needs to be my annual once a year rewatching of Inception.
Yeah. What holiday should it be matched to? Ooh. So that you have a holiday that you watch it on every year?
Arbor Day.
I would say Groundhog Day, but that's already taken.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Arbor Day just because
a lot of
all
trees.
the rings within it, you know, within a tree, they all look the same. And I'm really stretching here.
Are there any days for like sleeping, like any like sleep holidays?
Ooh, there needs to be.
is that all of the holidays?
Yeah, really. They're all just sleep-in holidays.
Okay, Arbor Day. Every Arbor Day, you have to watch Inception. That is now the rule. And there's no better holiday that for me to go, wait, Arbor Day's a thing? I totally forgot that.
Yeah, that's why I chose it, not going to lie, just because there's nothing else associated with Arbor Day. Now it's Inception Day.
Nice. There you go. So the Inception will be the best ever Tom Hardy movie, and we will move on to our final artifact. Second movie for review this week is Conclave.
The Pope is dead.
The throne is vacant.
What happened?
They say a heart attack.
You know how rumor spreads and 1.25 billion souls watching.
Well, Cardinal Lawrence.
It seems the responsibility for the conclave falls upon you.
The supervision of this election.
It's a duty I never thought I'd have to perform.
They are sequestered, and they must be shielded from all news that may influence their judgment. You understand?
After the unexpected death of the Pope, Cardinal Lawrence is tasked with managing the covert and ancient ritual of electing a new one. Sequestered in the Vatican with the Catholic Church's most powerful leaders until the process is complete, Lawrence finds himself at the center of a conspiracy that could lead to its downfall. Conclave is the name of the movie. It stars Ralph Fiennes, Isabella Rossellini, Stanley Tucci, John Lithgow, and was directed by Edvard Berger. Andrew Ormsby, did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay?
L-O-V-E, loved it.
That's good to hear. I also, L-O-V-E, all caps, love this movie. This is in contention. Welcome to award season.
Yeah.
This one is in contention for the best of the year. This movie is so good. Why don't you speak on it a little bit, Andrew?
I think that the cinematography, and like I said, every single time I start off a review for a movie and I don't immediately praise acting, it's because there's some great stuff going on in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the cinematography in this film is some of the best you'll ever see. Some of the establishing shots for the scenes in this film are straight out of a painting. It does an amazing job of helping the audience appreciate the history and the culture of the Catholic Church, particularly the Vatican. It's been, how can I best say this? there's an ancientness to the Catholic Church, and there's this newer Reformation, I guess you could say. Like, there's two parallel groups within the Catholic Church. One is for this new age, and one is for this older, stricter way that the Catholic Church used to be. It's very interesting to see how even in the holiest of holies, you can't escape political subterfuge. There's always something going on behind the scenes that are, you know, fingers pulling strings, you know, to... And it's interesting to see that dynamic, because there's a show I watch called The New Pope with... what's his face? And I'm... it's very similar to this show, or to this movie, in the fact that, you know, it deals with the Catholic Church, and it deals with, you know, all the things that go on behind the scenes. But there's something very intimate about this movie, and very evocative, and like, just in how it makes you like, oh, I got to learn everything about how, you know, the Catholic Church goes about electing a new pope, because this is so ritualized. It's so, and the thing I really appreciate about this movie, when it deals with the ritualistic element of it, is that it doesn't shy away from the minute details. Like, you'll sit there in scenes where Ray Fiennes is just getting adorned with the different garbs that he has to wear for a different day, you know, or for a different reason. So seeing all these things and how they, you know, are important, it makes me feel like I am being immersed in this world all that much more. And yeah, just all around, the cinematography was superb.
I agree. I struggle, if I'm being honest, Andrew, to find what isn't superb about this movie. From the cinematography to the score, to the way sound is used in this movie, there's a key moment where a vote is cast and something happens that is the combination of the way the sound is used and the shots you're seeing in the way you're seeing them and when certain things are revealed. Is it's just brilliant filmmaking. I mean, it is edge of your seat. It's clear that we are being led into the feeling of ominous, almost terror. There's almost a horror movie element to the way the score and the music is used here. Not that we're watching a horror movie in any way, shape, or form, but it gives the tension of the moment a real gravitas. So that's like done perfectly. The performances down the line are just perfect for the characters that they are. Ray Fiennes is so perfect as, you know, this Lawrence character who is trying to do the right thing and figure out what it means to elect the next pope, and, you know, interrogating his own
order
for that, how to do things, what, you know, how to keep the rules during, you know, certain things, certain times. Stanley Tucci is so good in this. John Lithgow is so good in this. I could just go through the entire cast and they're amazing, but I did want to mention a couple others. Lucien Mazmati has one of the most incredible scenes in the movie.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
It's just amazing. Even Sergio Castellito plays his role perfectly. Carlos Diz, who is this Cardinal Benitez that kind of shows up at the last second, and, you know, who is this guy? Like, all of that stuff is just perfect. The acting is just note perfect. You add to that the story is so tight, so compelling. It's kind of 12 Angry Popes in some ways. Like, there's this real element of politicking and trying to figure out what the right vote is, and the movie structure allows the audience, compels the audience to kind of play along and like, would he be a good pope? Would this guy be a good pope? Does this guy want it too much? Is this guy pretending not to want it, or do they really want it? And is like, was it this guy that did this sabotage-y thing? Or, you know, like the movie just has all of these moments and they all feel so important and so meaningful because of the way the movie brings you into them.
Yeah.
That's before we even get to the themes and messages of certainty and doubt. Yes. And what it means to, what is faith, and, you know, what it means to want to lead, leadership and politics. Like, all this stuff is just so deftly explored, and then the movie's ending is just another level of perfection in being willing to take the audience somewhere they didn't know they were going. And that's just, I just love it when a movie can do that. This movie is so good. It is certainly in my favorites of the year.
I figured as I was watching this movie that Ralph Fiennes was going to be my rock. And when I say that, I mean like a character that doesn't change throughout the movie, who is supposed to be, you know, who we see everything through his eyes, and we do, but to say that his character doesn't change is totally wrong. I think that by the end of this movie, he is a totally different person than what he was at the beginning of this movie, because there's the scene where he has the conversation with, I gotta remember how to, is it Adayemi? Lucian's character, I'm just gonna say that. Adamaya. Or something. I don't think the same person that has the conversation with him is the same person that has the conversation with Benitez at the very end of this movie.
No, I don't think so.
I think that tolerance, I think that openness, all play a huge factor. Ever since, and you were talking about the metaphors in this movie. There's a moment, my favorite moment in the entire movie is whenever you have Ralph Fiennes casting a vote for somebody. And then something in the outside world happens.
Right.
I'm trying to walk around spoilers here.
Mm-hmm.
But the metaphor and the subtle, or not subtlety, but the metaphor that's going on in that scene right there, just, it kind of made me think of like what God thought of Ralph Fiennes or Lawrence in that moment. You know?
I think it's subtler than that. I think we're supposed to be asking those questions because Ralph Fiennes is asking those questions, right? Like, he finds himself in that moment going, was this about me?
Yes.
Does this mean something? Mm-hmm. Like, and there's this aspect to religion of signs and wonders, right? Like this idea of God communicates through things that happen in our lives, and, you know, and not just Christianity or other mainstream religions, but even just in
faith in general.
Faith in general, and humanism in general. We all see meaning in the things that happen around us, you know, as like curses or blessings almost. Oh, this bird landed on, you know, this particular car. I think that's the one I'm supposed to buy, or, you know, whatever. We tend to see meaning in those things. And I think the movie is playing in that ground without actually giving us the answers. And I think that's really, really beautiful, because I feel like the movie itself is agnostic, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like the movie itself isn't saying God is speaking here, or, you know, there is no God, or it's silly that these men believe this, or whatever. Like, it's not saying any of those things. It's allowing us to understand that world through the men in the room, right? And occasionally women. And that's, you know, that's just, that's, and we haven't even talked about Isabella Rossellini, but, you know,
she needed more,
but at the same time, without giving too much away, like this movie is doing something very specific with the way the men and the women are used in this movie. And it's, yes, I wanted more from Isabella Rossellini, but I think I understand what the movie is saying and doing, because, you know, the church doesn't let the nuns in on that process, you know? Yeah. So, anyway, I think you're right that that is one of the most memorable scenes in the movie, but I think it's pretty subtle. I think it's pretty subtle what the movie is saying there. I think it lets the audience live through the eyes of the Lawrence character there and the others in the room. And Berger's he's just really good at that. We haven't mentioned that he kind of skyrocketed with All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah.
Last year. I think this is better too, and that's saying something.
Crazy.
All Quiet on the Western Front was great.
Yeah.
I really, really like the way that this movie finds itself in this space in a way that feels honest and authentic, and what it has to say about humans in this space. And there are no caricatures in this movie, right? I don't think there's anybody in this movie that's painted with, you know, a really big brush.
No, I don't think so. I think
maybe Tedesco.
But he's not mustache twirly.
No, not at all.
Every single person and the way they view faith and what faith means to them and what in what direction they feel the church should go seems valid. If not valid, understandable how they got to there. Authentic. Yeah.
Yeah. To that character. Yeah. I love it. I think this is expertly written, expertly executed. So
you mentioned something that I just want to echo because it didn't hit me until you said it. And then I realized that was the truth about the movie the entire time. And that's that faith in that the church in this movie is ambiguous. And by that, this movie isn't saying Christianity is right.
No.
Or that the Catholicism is right. It's all about what faith means to these individuals and how that faith pushes them forward in their belief and who they think should run the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's just so well done because it's easy to walk into a movie like this and think to yourself, oh, it's about the Catholic Church. It's obviously going to propagandize the Catholic Church in a good way. But I think that there are many instances in this movie where you can watch this and go, this is not painting the Catholic Church in a positive light the entire time. Far from it. I think it shows how beautiful the Catholic Church can be. And, you know, it's some people would even say archaic, but I think it's beautiful. Some of these traditions and rituals and things that they do, like the writing on the ballot. And then before you place the ballot in the urn or whatever it is, you have to talk to God and pray that what you're doing is right. Mm-hmm. And that leads immediately to whenever Ralph Fiennes cast his ballot to what happens. And it just makes that scene that much more beautiful. Ooh, this is a good movie, isn't it?
It really is. We can do one last thing and I'll start because the other place I wanted to draw attention to how specifically good I think Berger is with this movie is how quickly and how clearly he expositions the voting process and the voting participants without being clunky. And there will be, for instance, the first vote when they read the totals, and it happens a few times, and each time is different in the way it's presented. You'll see like the person that's being voted for as their name is called, which is, I mean, it's not like a complicated, like, oh, I can't believe he thought of that kind of thing. But the way he does it and consistently does it differently, there's one, I'll just give away this moment. I think it's really, really interesting. Where when they announce the person that's being voted
for,
it's just them. When they're all the other chairs where there should be cardinals are gone and empty, and it's almost mystical. There's something mystical about, you know, in that moment, and something's, you know, there's a meaning there of, you know, these men are being elevated beyond everybody else or set apart from everybody else. I thought all that stuff was really cool.
Do you have any cons with this movie?
I already told you that I was struggling to find them. I did not really find any.
I have one, but it's not that big of a con. I'm going to go with predictability.
Is it Clave? Is it Clave? Is that your con? Clave?
Clave?
Conclave?
You silly goose, you. It took me forever to get that. I should have caught that way, way sooner. No, I think that this movie suffers from predictability a little bit. Like, I knew...
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I mean, I completely disagree, but go ahead.
I think that maybe it's the fact that I found no other reason for them to introduce a specific character than for them to, at the end, have it be that person.
Sure, but come on. Like,
oh, are you talking about the reveal?
That's what I'm just saying. I'm just saying, without saying too much, that the predictability is a feature, not a bug, because it keeps you in a place of going, okay, this is the predictable thing. So, you know, where are the other options? And then, oh, well, it's the predictable. What? Like, that's like it is a very purposeful form of predictability, what you're talking about.
That they just put a twist on the end.
Well, more than that, but I'm talking around it, but I'm just saying, like, yeah. I think the movie is really smart about how it uses the audience's inclination towards solving the problem, solving the puzzle.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, we think we know what the puzzle is, and the movie is like, you weren't solving the right puzzle.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So
it does.
For me, that's a feature, you know, not in a bug.
Yeah. So my one last thing, my favorite moment in the movie is whenever Benitez gives his speech about war at the very end.
That speech,
I think that sums up faith for me and what religion should be.
If this movie had been a mess and that speech and Ralph Fiennes' homily both were in it, it'd still be an A+ for me. those two moments, I was like, oh, say more. It's so good. Yeah.
I want to watch it again. There's a rewatchability factor to this movie I did not expect.
Yeah,
and sure. I think it's the messaging, the cinematography, it's everything. It really is everything. There's so much good going on in this movie that I just want to experience it again.
There you go. That is Conclave. You can check it out in theaters now. Probably be on VOD here fairly shortly, and you're going to be hearing about it in the awards race for sure.
Yeah.
It's going to be a major contender, I believe. So there you go. That is Conclave. Well, we did it. We did it, Andrew.
I'm proud of us.
Congratulations. We managed to choose a podcast. A podcast.
I'm glad we remembered how to do this since it's been so long.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Sip Pop is part of the Studio DNA Podcast Network. You can find out more about other shows on the network by searching Studio DNA in your podcast player. Huge thanks to Andrew for hanging out.
Thank you, buddy.
Big thanks to producer Phil for producing the audio and video show.
Thanks, Phil.
Much love and gratitude to our Sip Pop members for giving monthly to make Sip Pop a real thing. Appreciate that. Support starts at $3 a month. You can check all that out at patreon.com/sifpop. Lots of ways to connect with the podcast. Leave a comment, a rating, or a review at Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen. You can also email us feedback@sifpop.com. And finally, if you're having a good time, your movie-loving friends will probably like the show too. So let them know about it and that listening is somehow even easier than figuring out if the Pope is Catholic. We'll be back next week with some more movie reviews. So we'll check you then.
Bye.